Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neuroscience Research Podcast. Today is April 4th, 2025, and we're talking with Poonam Pokum, who is assistant professor in the Department of Neuroscience and Experimental Therapeutics at the Texas A&M School of Medicine. Poonam's lab works on mechanisms controlling brain network excitability, including changes that accompany excitability disorders like epilepsy and traumatic brain injury. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me here.
It's good to have you. I'm Charlie Wilson, your host. So Poonam, big changes in brain activity produce big changes in osmotic regulation in the brain, and phenomena like epilepsy and some of the features of traumatic brain injury and spreading depression and depolarization are all associated with changes in extracellular space and cell volume. So could you start by explaining the cellular mechanisms that control cell volume and the movement of water across cell membranes, and then you start talking about how they change in some of those conditions?
Definitely. So in terms of traumatic brain injury, we know neurons, glial cells, they do swell after traumatic brain injury. And that occurs like, you know, a few hours after the injury. And that can, like, the swelling can continue for days after injury. One of the mechanisms...
You mean stay or getting worse and worse?
That's like, you know, we don't have any continuous monitoring of neuronal or glial swelling. What we have is the snapshots. Uh-huh. So that's one of the study that we are actually conducting as of now. It's like doing chronic monitoring so that we can understand, is it like a progressive increases or is it like, you know, just a transient increase, but over time it's kind of like, you know, gets reduced. Uh-huh. So that's, that question we still don't know, but hopefully, like, you know, with few studies that we are planning now, we'll get a clear picture of for neuronal swelling and also the astrocyte swelling. One of the mechanisms that we know that can cause neurons to swell is changes in the cation chloride transporters. These are mainly like, you know, sodium and potassium driven NKCC1 transporters and KCC2 transporters. And we know after TBI, they are also altered. So their expression can alter. But there is also a way that, like, you know, can influence the conductances through NKCC1, causing neurons to swell. So these are the main mechanism that we know in terms of neuronal swelling. For astrocyte swelling, aquaporin 4 has been well-known contributor for swelling in glial cells. And we also know that after TBI, expression of these aquaporins are altered, causing, like, you know, astrocytes to swell. So these are, like, you know, primary mechanism that can contribute to cytotoxic edema after TBI.
And the way these are work mm-hmm. is that they use the ionic balance between the inside and outside to drive the movement of water back and forth.
Exactly. So one way you can think about it's driven by, like, you know, sodium and potassium permeability or the concentration in and out of the cell. But there's also other way is just the changes in the transporter's number. If they're not pumping out the water enough, that can cause also swelling. Right? So there are two things.
So it's active.
Active, exactly. And so when I say about, like, you know, is it driven by changes in the sodium and potassium? Yes. If there are increases in the potassium in the extracellular space, that can drive, like, more conductances through NKCC1, irrespective of changes in the channel or transporter numbers. And if the extracellular potassium goes up, NKCC1 conductances can increase, causing water molecules to get into the cell, causing neurons to swell. So yeah, there are two mechanisms that can go hand in hand.
Yeah. And then the ions, they are regulated independently by other things like neuronal activity.
Exactly. And also the vascular changes, right? So we know after TBI or traumatic brain injury, we know blood-brain barrier permeability is affected. And what that's going to do is pump potassium from the blood vessel into the interstitial space. And that can cause increases in potassium, causing NKCC1 conductances increases in neurons. So that's one pathway. The other pathway is say, for example, neurons are just firing a lot. And if their firing action potentials consistently or their frequencies increase, during the repolarization of action potential, they're going to be pumping potassium into the extracellular space. In turn, there could be accumulation of potassium, causing, again, the conductances changes for driven by NKCC1. The third factor could be astrocytes not doing their job of clearing potassium and glutamate from extracellular space. So if neurons are firing, releasing potassium, glutamate, and astrocytes are not taking up, not doing their job of clearing potassium and glutamate, that can again cause extracellular accumulation of potassium, in turn changes in the NKCC1 driving cell swelling. So they are like, you know, multiple mechanisms that could cause neuronal swelling.
And they all
swelling.
Interact with each other.
Exactly.
Changes in extracellular volume alter the potassium concentration and so on. It sounds like you can easily get your brain in trouble from a osmotic perspective. So do we know what the consequences of that are? I mean, obviously, some part of the brain in traumatic brain injury is actually damaged, directly damaged. Mm-hmm. But then the spread of that is partly maybe mostly carried by these kinds of changes or
Yeah, so what we know, because I don't want to neglect the literature that existed, like, you know, in non-TBI, non-traumatic brain injury brains, uh-huh. because some of the experiments were also done by postdoc mentor Ed Dudek. So what they showed is when you change the osmolarity of the extracellular solution, like ACSF, in terms of, like, you know, the solution that we use, if you change the osmolarity, if you reduce the osmolarity, what you get is this, like, you know, synchronous firing of neurons. They're just crazily firing bunch of action potentials. So, like, you get something like seizure-like activity in brain slices if you change the osmolarity.
So how does that happen? What's causing that?
Yeah, so it's like, you know, I think the mechanism or the hypothesis that they had is when you are changing neuronal or astrocytes to their size, that changing the extracellular space. And what's happening is now neurons are coming physically close to each other, kind of, and they can just passively conduct the action potential currents because they are so close by. And that's what they call emphatic interaction. That could cause these seizure-like interactions or seizure-like discharges. And if you change the osmolarity, if you increase the osmolarity, you can reduce the seizure-like discharges. So that's what, like, you know, some of the mechanism we know in the non-TBI brain. But what we found out in a few years ago when we tried studying this, like, you know, what neuron swelling is doing to the brain excitability, what we found is when neurons are swollen, this actually decreases excitability of neurons, their intrinsic excitability is decreased, and it's also on the network level, they are less excitable. So network excitability is also reduced.
So that's something. The extracellular space presumably is shrunk.
Yeah.
And the cells are really close together, but for some reason that doesn't cause them to be overexcited.
Yeah, but that's also, like, you know, one thing, all the emphatic interaction mediated synchronous firing following, like, you know, osmolarity changes, they were done in hippocampus, where we know the architecture of the CA1, like, you know, pyramidal neurons, they're physically close to each other, right? Their neurons are
Absolutely.
Just packed, right?
Yeah.
Cortex, that's not the situation. So we are recording in layer 2-3 somatosensory cortex.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons could be we are seeing this effect, maybe it's just a region specific, right? So that's what I think, because, you know, unless I do recordings in the hippocampus to show that there's also reduced excitability, I'm not going to just say that, oh, I do expect the same kind of changes or reduced excitability in the hippocampus.
So do we know, not worrying about that, but just thinking about the phenomenon you're seeing, what do we think is causing that reduction in excitability?
Yeah, I think it's to do with the cells, like the neurons swollen they have now their capacitance, the membrane capacitance is increased. And one hypothesis that we had is like there are now more receptors or channels that can conduct the currents. They are more in numbers now after TBI, just because of their size increases. And if they are like, you know, conducting more, their input resistance is going to be reduced. And what that's going to do, if there's a less input resistance, you need more currents, any synaptic currents, to make changes in the voltage in the cell, at the cell level. So this intrinsic excitability reduction is what's causing the network to be less excitable. That's what we think is
happening. So I know you've measured the intrinsic excitability a lot, so you can answer the key questions about that for me. Like, one reason a cell might become less excitable is that it just has a more negative membrane potential.
So yeah, so
threshold. So can you tell us what happens to the membrane potential?
That's a great question. So we did not see differences in the resting membrane potential. Uh-huh. We also did not see changes in the threshold for action potential firing. So because that's one of the things that we hypothesized initially, that if even though we are recording in the area that's far from the injury site, these are supposed to be the spared neurons, right? The spared cells, which should be functionally active. But what if they are also just, their membrane potential is so depolarized that now they are not going to be excitable anymore because they are close to the, like, universal potential.
Oh, they could be in depolarization block.
Exactly. So we did not see that difference between, like, you know, resting membrane potential between sham and TBI.
So you still see neurons firing normally. They're not in depolarization block.
Yeah. They're only firing low in numbers, but there was no differences in, like, you know, the threshold for action potential firing. Yeah.
So what are the other measurements we use when we don't see membrane potential or threshold changes? We look at the input resistance.
Mm-hmm.
So a neuron has a small input resistance.
Yeah, so input resistance, yeah, after TBI, they were reduced. And so one can say that, like, you know, just by looking at the Ohm's law, it's like simple Ohm's law, V equals IR. If the input resistance is less, the voltage changes are going to be smaller also, right? And so, you know.
So it just takes a lot more synaptic input, or a lot more current.
Exactly.
To make the cell fire.
Yeah, so that's why they are less excitable. So even though the input coming in is maybe the same for sham and TBI neurons, but the voltage changes are going to be just smaller for TBI. They need more, double the input that sham neurons would receive.
So that is like double? It's
like, I'm making the number. But like, you know, something like higher the synaptic input that they need in order to make similar voltage changes.
So do we think this is a good thing for the recovery from, because the idea, I think, mm-hmm. I mean, you correct me about this, but I think the idea is that there's a damaged region in the center, mm-hmm. and then there's a region of brain that's at risk mm-hmm. around there, and that part could go either way. It could die or it could recover,
mm-hmm.
and the trick is to try to get as much of it to recover as possible. So now if we know that part of the brain is getting quiet,
mm-hmm.
or is it the whole brain, or is it, does it have to be near the damage to go quiet like that, or is it the whole brain?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. What we recorded is almost like 1 to 2 millimeter far from the injury site.
So that's pretty close still.
Yeah, still it's close. But mm-hmm. I think we are also now doing a little bit further from the injury site to see, like, you know, is there like kind of like a graded area, right? Like close to, say, if it's 1 to 2 millimeter, even we are talking about the mouse brain, right? 1 to 2 millimeter, you have hypoexcitability. But what if, like, you know, if you go a little further, do you have something different? Or is it like, you know, it doesn't matter?
Or maybe you could be looking in the thalamus or in the red nucleus, and the whole brain is kind of decreasing its excitability.
So that's again the great point. We are also now recording in the thalamic regions, VPM mainly, where we want to understand, like, you know, how that region is affected after TBI. Whether there is, like, based on literature, we know after TBI, weeks later, there is like a neuronal loss in the thalamus. But there's also like, you know, not chronic recordings to show are there like immediate changes, or there's really nothing happens until a week later, the injury, that thing starts like, you know, dying. Or the cell starts dying.
So that
and it could
be
the synaptic input coming, synaptic input coming from the cortex is less, and so neurons are not receiving the synaptic input, and they are just eventually dying.
Or even the thalamic neurons no longer have a target.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And so degenerate in the retrograde direction, which thalamic neurons are famous.
Yeah, that's a great point. And so that also brings back to my... brings to my next point, that we also need to look at, like, you know, layer four, which is like layer four of the cortex, which is like more the recipient of thalamic input, how that's affected, and also layer six, which sends out the like output to thalamus, how that's affected. So, like, you know, we still don't know how, like, you know, these cortical layers, how they are altered. Different layers are altered after TBI, and how that contributes to the subcortical regions. Yeah.
So to evaluate whether this change in excitability is something we ought to treat people for, or something we ought to be happy that it's happening, you know, and leave it alone, because the question is that promoting the destruction of brain tissue, or is it protecting against the destruction of brain tissue?
So that's like, you know, it's a great question. So I have talked to few of the neurosurgeons, okay? So one neurosurgeon, he was very excited. He's from University of Utah. He was very excited when he read a paper where we showed the neuronal swelling needs to be conserved. We need that protection, because if you reduce the neuronal swelling, everything is going to get chaotic. You are going to get increased excitability, which you don't want it, presumably. You don't want seizures. You don't want, like, you know, spreading depolarizations like event. So what he was interested in kind of like mimicking our study in the severe TBI, traumatic brain injury model, because most of the patients that come to the ER, emergency department, it's mostly like, you know, they are... they have severe traumatic brain injury, not the moderate TBI injury that we studied. So he got excited because there is also, like, you know, he has seen clinical patients. He has seen some, like, you know, literature where even though you try to reduce intracranial pressure following TBI, those patients do not do better over time. They actually do worse.
And the intracranial pressure is caused by the brain swelling.
The brain swelling,
this
exactly.
This is the two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why he was very excited. He's like, maybe the findings that you have, they have some clinical implications. So that is something that we have to continue in order to understand, because you don't want the increased excitability like seizures and spreading depolarization. But what about, like, you know, if there's a hypoactivity, what it's doing to the learning and memory? If there's a reduced activity, like, are we saying that the plasticity, or, like, you know, plasticity, which is one of the mechanism for learning and memory, is it also affected? If that's true, then we don't want to protect neuronal swelling. Like, you know, we don't want to have neuronal swelling.
Well, how long is the danger area? So I'm kind of picturing, here's been some damage, and now there's a damaged place. There's probably no bringing it back, but there's a region around this that's now at risk, and the damage could spread to that region, or it might not, or it might spread a little ways and then be checked by whatever natural processes check that. And then what happens? I mean, is everything going to reach some kind of steady state, and you can quit worrying about whether the brain is swelling or not swelling, because it's going to go back to normal, the part that doesn't die? Or is this a brain swelling, something that's going to go on forever after this event?
Yeah, so in animal models, what we have seen is like 7 days post-TBI, everything recovers. So cell swelling.
If the brain just shut itself off and didn't learn anything for 7 days, but that caused it to recover, it wouldn't be a high price to pay.
Yeah, but the thing is, what if the changes that are happening at 48 hours because of the brain swelling, right? If they're worse or good, if you're not taking care of that time, you are going to see changes at 1 week post-TBI. So that's another project that we want to do, is like, when you protect neuronal swelling early on, what are the long-term effects? And if you don't treat neuronal swelling, that we have seen, like, you know, not treating neuronal swelling and 7 days everything recovers, but the excitability is increased.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, you know, we need that long-term recordings where we understand this, like, swelling and excitability relationship.
Yeah.
The other thing is, like, the point that you made is you have injury and then you have this kind of, like, at-risk area around it, right? You are envisioning this as, like, you know, stroke, where we have a lesion and then we have,
I'm
like,
thinking
you know,
about right, exactly,
like,
a stroke. The same as
stroke. Yeah, yeah. But one thing that always, like, amazes me is, like, in the stroke, we know the infarct area, the mirror, what's, like, you know, all damaged. The sparing depolarization, like, event, when it occurs there, it propagates to, like, those spared areas, right? But then there would be sparing depolarization coming from the spared area towards the lesion, okay?
Yeah.
But in case of traumatic brain injury, whenever we have recorded sparing depolarization, we have always seen sparing depolarization propagating from the injury site.
One way only.
One way, and that's it. We don't see sparing depolarization for like 5 hours, 6 hours. But there's also, like, you know, we don't have long-term monitoring of sodium sparing depolarization after TBI to know, is it like one hit or is it like, you know, we get multiple over days maybe. So that always amazes me, like, why one sparing depolarization?
If now we have to talk about sparing depolarization. We should.
Yeah, so, definitely. So let me just give, like, you know, background on what is sparing depolarization. So sparing depolarization is the excitability phenotype that has been seen in epilepsy patients. Like, it's a clinical phenotype that has been seen in epilepsy patients and also traumatic brain injury patients. And in animal models, what we know is when you induce sparing depolarization, you can induce sparing depolarization if you increase the neuronal firing, if you increase extracellular potassium, if you increase glutamate, you can induce sparing depolarization.
And what's this look like?
Huh?
How do we detect sparing depolarization?
Yeah, so sparing depolarization, yeah. So once it occurs, it kind of like, you know, if you are recording from single neuron and you are inside the cell, your whole cell patch clamped and you're recording membrane potential, what you see is the massive depolarization that occurs. And the magnitude of this depolarization can be like 50, 60 millivolts.
So it loses its membrane potential.
Exactly.
Basically.
And but then it does recover in, like, you know, 2 minutes or so. Then if you are, like, you know, in the extracellular space and you have, like, you know, just the electrode recording local field potential, what you see is the large negativity in the extracellular space, like, you know, in the potential.
With the same duration.
Same kind of like 1 to 2 minutes duration.
Yeah.
If you record astrocyte membrane potential, you also see that kind of, like, you know, massive depolarization, and the duration would be also longer, like, you know, 2 minutes. So this sparing depolarization, let me compare it to, like, seizures, which we all know how the seizures are, like, you know, how kind of like crazy activity we see during seizures. It's like lots of neurons are firing continuously, right, during seizure activity. But here in the sparing depolarization, what happens is at the initiation, like at the start of the event, you see some neurons firing, like, you know, you see some action potential, but then neurons would just depolarize, that there won't be any action potential firing or anything because it would be close to the, you
just
know,
in block.
And then it would return back, like, you know, after 2 minutes. But that during that whole period, it just, the cells are depolarized, right? The neurons are depolarized. So that's what you would see at the cell level if you record potassium or glutamate in the extracellular space. What you see is, again, the dramatic increases, like potassium can go up to like 40 millimolar in concentration. In contrast, during seizures, we know it can go up to like 6 to 10 millimolar or 12 millimolar increases in extracellular potassium. So you can see the magnitude.
This is an extreme
of
event.
Exactly. It's like, you know, it's so extreme event. But even though, like, you know, now people have been, like, you know, realizing that it's not just, like, you know, sparing depolarization, shunting, or shutting down the neuronal activity, there's more to it. What I mean by that, so in epilepsy literature, if you talk to anyone doing epilepsy, if they are studying seizures in slices, what they see is like bunch of seizure activity, and then you would get this sparing depolarization event, which would cause postictal depression, and that can last for, like, you know, 20 minutes.
The brain just goes quiet.
Quiet, like, you know, it's just depression compared to the background activity that's seen before seizure. So, like, you know, if you talk to an epilepsy person, they would be like, oh, it's just terminating seizures. Okay, because what's happening is you get these seizures, and then seizures would kind of like culminate into sparing depolarization. So when you look at, like, you know, just when you filter out this DC recording or the negative shift in the field potential, what you see is a flat line following seizure.
But a flat line isn't just the absence of a seizure, it's a flat line.
Yeah, so what people always say is that it's terminating seizures, so it's good. Because we want to terminate seizures, right?
Yeah.
So it's a good thing. What we don't understand is the tissue, if it's going through sparing depolarization, that means there is, like, inherent or there is intrinsic hyperexcitability that's, like, you know, increased, or the excitability is increased to the level that now it's going into, like, you know, the sparing depolarization event. And we also know sparing depolarization can cause tissue damage, like, you know, histology, like, you know, if you do a bunch of histology, you can see, like, you know, there's more reactivity of the astrocytes, there's more damage, cell loss. So it's not just terminating seizures, it's actually doing more than that.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, like, you know, I think...
it's the ultimate excitation. So if there's excitotoxicity, that's when it's going to happen.
Exactly. It's like, you know, yes, it is terminating seizures, but you are getting this massive event that you don't want you to have, right?
So I have a bunch of questions about it. I don't want to just end up asking a bunch of questions, but I do want to ask a bunch of questions. So one is, you know, if you just dump a bunch of glutamate on neurons, they'll depolarize very powerfully, like up to zero, and you could think, oh, that's all there is to it, but that doesn't happen to astrocytes. They don't just depolarize up to zero when you dump a bunch of glutamate on them.
Yeah.
So so what's the relationship between glutamate and neurons and astrocytes? Can we kind of put together a sequence of events that causes this giant depolarization? And then, if we can do that, what stops it? Why didn't it just stay depolarized forever?
Yeah. Good questions. So, you know, like, one of the experiments that our PhD student, when he was, like, trying to, like, you know, we were working on the sequence of the sparing depolarization. One of the experiments that he did, he actually, like, you know, he was doing brain brain slice electrophysiology. He was increasing glutamate concentration, and he patched neuron. And just by increasing glutamate concentration, what he saw was, like, neurons were not actually depolarizing to that extent. There were actually some neurons would have, like, you know, upstate-like event. The cells would depolarize, would come back. Sometimes they would have action potentials. But there wouldn't be greater response in neuronal depolarization following changes in the glutamate concentration. In contrast, if you increase potassium, neurons would depolarize. You would get that graded response. And when he showed that, and that's, like, you know, we knew it based on, like, you know, experiments where people have done just the glutamate, like, you know, in the glutamate puff and trying to induce STs. It's not sparing depolarization. Sorry, I keep saying STs. They were not able to induce sparing depolarization. But if they block glutamate transporters, like, you know, astrocytes have glutamate transporters, neurons have. If they block that, then they can induce brain depolarization.
Because then the glutamate just hangs around.
Exactly. Because what I think is in the brain slice or in vivo, when you are puffing glutamate or when you are trying to increase glutamate in the extracellular space, these transporters are very active. They are doing their job. So there won't be, like, you know, enough glutamate that could cause sparing depolarization. Yeah. So that's one of the things that I...
So when you see this happening in a traumatic brain injury or near stroke, then what do you think happened? I mean, maybe it was glutamate that caused the potassium release in the first place or something?
I think it's a
chicken
and egg.
But it's really the potassium. It's really potassium because without the potassium, you couldn't get...
Yeah, so it's actually a very chicken and egg question. Who comes first? Is it potassium or the glutamate? So the techniques, so the experiments where we recorded extracellular potassium with, like, you know, potassium-sensitive electrodes. Then we recorded glutamate with the genetically encoded glutamate indicator. Then we recorded astrocyte membrane potential, which we know can be used as a potassium electrode, right? Because astrocytes depolarize, astrocytes can depolarize any smaller changes in extracellular potassium. So they are, like, you know, very well-known potassium indicator. So we did a bunch of experiments where we were, like, you know, recording astrocytes membrane potential, extracellular potassium, then extracellular glutamate changes during just sparing depolarization in the naive animals. And what we saw that these astrocytes, their potassium increases or astrocytes membrane potential changes that precedes the sparing depolarization event. And the potassium increases in the extracellular space that changes occur at, like, you know, just 5 seconds before the sparing depolarization. But it does occur before glutamate increases. But one can argue that the indicator that you have for glutamate recordings, maybe it's not sensitive enough, that it doesn't record, like, you know, small changes.
Yeah, when everything's happening at once, it's kind of hard to find out who's the,
exactly.
who's the leader.
So, yeah, so there is, like, you know, 5 second delay between potassium and glutamate. And if you think, like, astrocyte membrane potential is the ultimate potassium electrode, these membrane potential changes are happening almost like 20, 30 seconds before sparing depolarization. So if you think it's only extracellular potassium changes causing astrocytes to depolarize, then one can say it's a potassium driven. But I don't buy that. I think it's a glutamate.
In experiments, people often just add some potassium, dab a little potassium on the cortex and start a sparing depression of it. But in damaged brain tissue, why do they happen?
Because I think the injury that we are inducing, there's lots of damage. Cells are dying and they are just, like, you know, dumping glutamate, potassium, and that, like, you know, we know there could be local increases in potassium. And that's, like, you know, it's a perfect, like, you know, trigger to induce pain.
So that would explain why there would be a generator at the site of damage.
Exactly.
And not out at the edges.
Yeah.
So now I don't want to fail to ask you about what stops them. So if you can make these measurements of potassium going up and glutamate going up and so on, then and membrane potential going up, then you can also make them on the falling phase of the depolarization too. And what do you see there?
Yeah, so the glutamate changes, they, like, you know, even though they occur at the time of sparing depolarization, they recover within, like, you know, 20 seconds, way before neurons' membrane potential recovers. Neuron and membrane potential recovery, it's kind of like relates to what happens in the extracellular potassium recovery. So the timeline, like, you know, the time that it takes for potassium to recover, it's kind of the same for the neuron and membrane potential to recover.
So some kind of potassium clearance mechanism is kicking in and knocking this thing down.
Yeah, yeah. So one hypothesis that we always have been working with is if you make astrocytes more functional of clearing their, like, you know, clearing extracellular potassium and glutamate, can you delay or can you reduce spending deposition happening?
So one thing you said earlier was if you reverse the swelling, that those spreading depolarization events will be more frequent.
Yeah.
So do we have a clue about why that would, how the swelling is connected to the to the generation of those?
Yeah, so I think swelling, one thing you would expect is when the cells are swollen, the extracellular potassium, I think we talked about this when, the extracellular potassium, the concentration can be increased just because the extracellular space is now shrunk, right? Yeah. Because the cells are swollen. In that case, what you would expect is the local neuron hyperexcitability. But it's also if the extracellular space is shrunk, you can imagine if there is spreading depolarization happening, the diffusion, the propagation would be limited just because of the extracellular space being
because
limited.
Because it's spreading because potassium is
diffusing. Of course, there is also intercellular pathway of the astrocytes that can also cause the propagation, but I think it's mostly also the neuronal depolarization spreading, and also it's also potassium diffusion to the extracellular space, causing spreading depolarization to spread. But when you reduce neuronal swelling, increases in excitability and also increases in number of spreading depolarization event, it's if you don't have that protective effect of cell swelling, if you take away that protective effect, now the intrinsic excitability is going to be high. The cells are going to be more intrinsically excitable. Uh-huh. And you can imagine if there are a bunch of neurons are more hyperexcitable, they're at that threshold. So any trigger can drive
start the explosion, and the potassium explosion.
Exposure, and they can also have more number of spreading depolarization just because excitability is now increased.
So a spreading depression events, like spreading depolarizations, which are also
caused spreading depression,
and have been studied for years, and those things propagate over the over in the entire cortex, not just in a little animal's cortex, but on human cortex all the way along. So in traumatic brain injury, when those things are happening, do they go everywhere in the cortex like that? So I kind of wonder because, occasionally people have postulated that migraine is connected to spreading depression somehow, and I know that we don't have time to go through that whole story, but I wonder if you could know what it feels like to have spreading depression, if one of these events were to just happen to me right now, somebody was secretly putting some potassium chloride on my cortex, and this wave of depolarization and depression went through my cortex, would I just go unconscious during that, you think? Because my cortex would just go quiet, my EEG would flatline and for 20 minutes and then I would recover. Do we have any, I'm not asking you to make up something.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. So in migraine, I know when the spine depolarization is also underlying mechanism for migraine with aura. And I know migraine aura, my colleagues have migraine aura, and they have of course they must be getting spreading depolarization. We know because clinically people, there's a bunch of study that show that when the patients have aura and if you record their both signal, right, the blood oxygenation signal, they mimic spreading depolarization signal. So I know it's happening.
So maybe you wouldn't go unconscious. Possibly you would just see a hallucination or something.
Yeah, exactly. So one thing that I remember my colleague telling me, whenever he has migraine auras, he would be kind of stupid for 24 hours. He wouldn't be like, you know, smart. Right. And he's like MD, he's like very smart person, but like he would be kind of like, you know, just like
sleepy.
And like he wouldn't be like, you know, sharp.
Yeah.
That's what I've heard. But it's also very like, you know, subjective. He may be analyzing more for himself. But in animal studies, because clinical studies where they have recorded spine deposition, these are also like, you know, patients who have traumatic brain injury. And these recordings were done within like, you know, 10 days of their like, you know, when they are admitted to the ER. So that time, most of the patients are they're unconscious. So it's like, I don't know if there is any data or maybe I'm just missing on the clinical data. But in animals data, we know that there's actually recent publication that showed that when there is a spine deposition, that can actually increase the activity in animals. There will be more like, you know, the movement will be more.
It's remarkable because your cortex would be completely like flatlined and you're running around.
Exactly.
Doing stuff.
But if you look at like, you know, epilepsy literature, what we know is when the spine depolarization cause that's associated with like, you know, depression, it's a associated with postictal depression. What we know is like this postictal depression can be associated with like, you know, immobility in patients. In epileptic patients. So
which
it's
is what
like,
you'd expect, really.
Exactly.
Yeah. I would think if my motor cortex goes flatline, I'm probably not going to be moving
around. I wouldn't say flatline. It's like it was reduced. But yeah, if it's reduced activity, you would expect like, you know, less mobility or less activity, like motor coordination, not like, you know, hyper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot. Poonam, this has been really fun talking to you.
Thank you so much. This was really great. This is the first time I'm doing it, but it just felt awesome.
Good.
Thank you.
This has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.